But it was one of their early confrontation scenes. But Bridget is getting the idea that her identity is being usurped. And the scene wasn't going particularly well or whatever, and Barbet Schroeder just stopped everybody and said, "Stop. Everybody go home. You know, we're too tired. We're not going to bang our head against the wall. Let's go home. We'll come back tomorrow and start fresh." Again, another move that takes enormous guts. And then Barbet looked at me and winked and smiled when everybody left and said, "That's money." Mm-hmm. And the next day, everybody came in at 7:30 and got down in like one take. Bing, bang, boom. Yet, you know, the really great directors have courage of telling the story the way they want to tell the story. And that's another thing the great directors have in common.
Yeah, I mean, I actually got to meet Barbet at Ebert Fest this year. I don't know if he told you the story about how he was not getting financing for Barfly. And some of the studio heads or the people he was looking for financing, when they were refusing to give him money, I think he threatened to cut off his finger.
No.
Oh, that's what he said. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, yeah. It may not be telling you exactly, it's a little hazy, but he did threaten to cut off his finger with a cigar cutter.
Well, you know, he was big into those cigars.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Oh, he is such a card. You know, Barbet is, Barbet was a great French actor in the Eric Rohmer film.
Mm-hmm.
And to see Barbet in those early movies is remarkable. There was one of them I remember. Gosh, it feels like it was shot in the early 50s. Barbet was like, you know, a matinee idol.
Mm-hmm.
But he was always a little sinister, I think. A little sinister around the edges.
You actually mentioned The Insider. What was it like working with Michael Mann? I've heard a lot of stories. I mean, the guy is a perfectionist, from what I've heard. What do you think, what was your experience like doing that?
I've never worked on anything like it in my life. I think we worked on it for over a year. For over a year. And, part of it was Christopher Plummer was doing a Broadway show somewhere in the middle of it, in the middle of the shoot, and so they arranged it around his Broadway appearance. But we started shooting, then we stopped, then we started again. But it seemed to take, I remember almost like my first read-through with everybody in Louisville, Kentucky was, I want to say like February, and I don't think we were finished. I was finished shooting until like almost November, and that's very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, first of all, I loved working with Michael Mann.
Yeah.
That is like awesome. The stuff was beautiful, great director. Again, all of these directors that I've heard stories and rumors that are great technical directors like Michael Mann, Ridley Scott, Al Parker, they are great actors directors.
Mm-hmm.
Because they understand what actors do and they give you a firm foundation to act from. You know, you feel very well supported. I remember this is not so much a Michael Mann story, but it is an insider story.
Mm-hmm.
We had finished one of the stories, and I had a thing with Al Pacino, and we had finished that scene, and we came off, and Al was hugging everybody and said, "Oh, fantastic. We're great, Steven. Thank you." And, you know, generous, sweet guy. We all thought the scene went really well. Michael allowed Al to do whatever he wanted. He gave him a He did the scene 10 different ways. It was amazing to watch. So we finished the scene, and we're doing, as actors always do, kind of a little post-mortem at the end of the scene about what they liked and what they didn't like. And while we're doing the post-mortem, Al is putting on this big old floppy hat. Then he puts on this fake beard. He puts on these glasses. Then he puts on this scarf, this old tattered coat with holes in it. And I'm going, Al, what are you doing, man? What's going on? And he goes, Steven, I can't go anywhere. You see, I can't go anywhere. Now, right now we were shooting in New York, not far from Central Park.
Right.
And he says, I'm going to leave this building. I'm going to walk down the street and go to Central Park. Then I'm going to cross Central Park and go get into a car on the west side. And that car is going to drive me out to my house. Because I can't be seen anywhere because people come up to me. Al explained to me that there are many stages of life. There's a stage in your life when you work on your education, and then when you work on your career, and when you work on your family life. And then there is a stage in your life in which you are involved in lawsuits. And this is the stage that Al says nobody ever knows about when you achieve a certain amount of fame that he has achieved. That people will come up to him at a restaurant and try to pick a fight with him. People will try to bang into his car. People will throw every kind of lawsuit they could think of at him to try to get money from him. So Al is resorting to walking around in disguise in New York to get into a private car to get him out to his home in one piece. And sadly enough, you know, one of my old schoolmates, Kathy Bates, I've done about 4 or 5 movies with Kathy, and one of the last ones I worked on, she was saying, people doing the same thing to her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like trying to cause a ruckus in a restaurant, banging into her car, something like that. To get into a lawsuit. So it's a sad state of events out there.
Yeah, I mean, God, bring up Kathy Bates. I love Kathy Bates. Just wonderful performances. I guess I was wondering about The Insider specifically. There's one scene, and you might be knowing sort of what I'm talking about. I don't know if you were on set for this scene, or if you... I'm sure you've seen the movie, but it's the scene where Bruce McGill chews out the lawyer, the tobacco lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Were you on set for that, or
In fact, I think that was shot in another state. I think that particular scene was shot in Mississippi, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I shot in Kentucky, L.A., and New York.
Yeah, I mean, that's just an incredible scene. But anyway, so you recently started this podcast called the Steven Tobolowsky, or the Tobolowsky Files, hosted by David Chen of Slash Film, the Slash Filmcast. You were guest a couple times on the Slash Filmcast. I believe the first time you were there, you reviewed... I think a movie that David loved called The Mummy 3. It was his favorite movie that year, I think. And I guess, how did this get started? Because I got to be honest, I love listening to these stories. And it's very, it's like pulling, you know, getting a book and, you know, going up to, you know, cuddling up to the fire and reading a great story. How did you get started?
Well, I think I got to set the record straight. First of all, let's talk about Mummy 3. Out of everybody in that group, everybody was eviscerating the Mummy 3.
Yeah, I know. It's
just saying, hey, you know, nobody ever, even the Mummy 3 wasn't saying that they were trying to be, you know, Citizen Kane. I said the Mummy 3 is one of those movies that actually delivers exactly
what it
promises. So I did not trash
No, no, I was talking about Dave loved The Mummy 3. It's a popular joke on the Slash Filmcast that he, someone wrote in that he hated The Dark Knight and loved The Mummy 3.
Yes, and that is probably, you know, that is probably true, knowing the devious mind of Dave.
Yeah.
You know, that is sad. But I did a movie called Stephen Tobolowsky's Birthday.
Yes.
Which was based on an idea my friend, who's a cinematographer, Robert Brinkman, had years and years and years ago. I used to stand in the kitchen of our old house and tell, like, stories about movies. And Brinkman said, this is so entertaining. Why don't we do a movie just with the camera on you and you tell some of these crazy movie stories?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, great. Yeah, that's really going to work. We didn't do anything until, I guess, like, 5 years ago, and Brinkman and I were both not working at the same time, and we called each other up almost the same week and said, hey, you know that movie where I tell the stories? Why don't we do that now? And what really helped was the invention of HD, because now instead of having to find financing for hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of film and film cameras, with just a few thousand dollars, and I mean very few, we could finance the movie ourselves with HD and borrow the equipment. So we shot for basically 3 days. I think four when you add some of the extra little interview scenes we did. We shot with no script, no preparation, no rehearsal, no permits, cameras on our back. We shot this movie that starts at dawn that goes to midnight, presumably on my birthday, where I tell true stories from movies and my life. And in editing this movie, and this is a true story,
mm-hmm.
in fact, it should be in the next movie, one of the discs that our editor, Andy, was working from, was left in the equipment we had borrowed.
Oh.
So when we returned the equipment, when they returned the equipment back, that particular equipment went to HBO. So they get, HBO gets their equipment back, and there's a disc in there, and they look at it, and it is the rough cut of Stephen Tobolowsky's Birthday Party. Next thing we know, we get a phone call from HBO saying, this stuff is hilarious. Would you guys like to premiere your movie at the HBO Comedy Festival?
Yes.
And we went like, huh? Sure. So anyway, we put the movie together in 90 minutes. We premiered it at the Comedy Festival in Aspen, and then from then, it has gone to South by Southwest in Austin. It sold out London. It won Best Documentary and Comedy in the L.A. High Definition Film Festival. You know, and I don't know if that's good. I mean, we're talking about comedy and documentary,
mm-hmm.
and it's about my life. This is sad. But we also opened the Bologna Film Festival in Italy, Buenos Aires, Montreal, all over the world. And David Chen saw this movie on his own. We didn't send it to him. He saw it and he loved it. And he called me up and said, will you come on Slash Film and talk about Birthday Party? So that is how David Chen and I met. And I did like three different movie reviews on mm-hmm. Slash Film. I think I did Mummy 3, I did Where the Wild Things
Are. Yeah, Talhud.
I'm one of the people who love that one.
And yeah.
At a break, when we were doing Where the Wild Things Are, David said, would you consider doing a Birthday Party Part 2?
Mm-hmm.
Where you do, and these are the rules I have, Josh, for stories. The stories have to be true, they have to happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't tell, quote, the true story of what happened to my babysitter's boyfriend when they went on a vacation to Pebble Beach.
Hey, that would be compelling.
It's a great story, but you can't vouch for the details. But
mm-hmm.
I tell stories that are true that happened to me. And so we started the podcast doing film stories about life, love, and the entertainment industry. And we were going to start out by doing a few and seeing where we ended up with it. And the first season, I think we ended up doing like 25 different podcasts. real stories where I do kind of the behind-the-scene thing. And I do stories, too, about my life, like mm-hmm. when I first fell in love, when I first found out I was going to be a father, you know, real stories that are kind of universal. So that's kind of how the podcast developed and what it is.
Yeah, I think the first episode was the Halloween one. We were talking about the Halloween party that you eventually got to see. You got to visit Elvis's home, didn't you?
The Graceland.
Yeah, Graceland. Yeah.
I thought I was going to be kidnapped and murdered, and I ended up at Graceland at 2 in the morning. Yeah.
Yeah, and you gave some advice on Halloween about how to get laid, and all I will say is that was very good advice. We'll leave it at that.
Excellent.
Yes, it was very good advice.
Especially if you're a man and you're losing your hair, don't go dressed as a vampire.
Yeah,
that'd work.
Yeah, I definitely followed that advice. I guess. Well, first of all, actually, I'd like to. Tell one of the stories you did. You talked about when your mother died.
Yes.
Recently, that story reached me a lot because recently my grandmother died, and I think it was something that we knew we were expecting to happen. And when it did happen, you know, I think right before the funeral, the day before I left for the funeral, I listened to that podcast, and it was very. It helped me work through, I mean, you know, it helped sort of help me deal with some of the sort of pain. So,
That's episode 4.
Yeah, I think so.
On the podcast called The Alchemist, and kind of what happened was, I teach a class in improvisation, another one in comedy, and I had done kind of basically the Halloween story, which centered around Great Balls of Fire. My second podcast I did was kind of about Davy Crockett, but also about when I was doing children's theater in L.A., and the podcast was about working on Wild Hogs. They were all movie-oriented, and I was telling the story in my class about the day my mother died, and while I was telling it and trying to get through the story, I was going like, why don't I tell stories like this in the mm-hmm. podcast? Because this is as important or more important to hear than like stories about Wild Hogs. So I told David Chin, I said, we're going out on a limb this week, and I'm doing a different story. It ain't going to be film or anything at all. I'm going to do the story about the day my mom died. And it's the sign of a good producer. You know, David mm-hmm. Chin said, go with it, man. Go with it. We'll see what it is. And that sort of, that particular episode redefined the podcast. And it kind of opened it up to all sorts of other topics that normally I wouldn't have thought about doing. And in that first season, I talk about problems of college and teachers that treat you unfairly. And
yeah.
First jobs you have and graduate school and problems I had there. Josh, I have gotten so many letters from all over the country in particular and a few from around the world, but of people who said, like, the stories you told about getting through college and graduate school, my God, it's my life. It's mm-hmm. what I'm living through now. And it really, really helped to hear that somebody else had been in that same place for what you did. So, that's kind of the good feeling that I get from the podcast. You feel that you really have kind of reached out and helped people in some little way, in knowing that they're not so alone with dealing with some of the big problems in their life.
Yeah, and by the way, the I think you mentioned a sort of Hebrew school passage or a question that you were talking about during the one when you talked about how you got through school.
Yes.
I totally remember that question being brought up in Hebrew school. That was, yeah. Which, by the way, I'm being Jewish myself. I wanted to ask you what it was, the challenges of being a Jewish actor in Hollywood, but I guess that'll be for another day. but anyways, so you, it now are these stories that you tell? Are these stories that appeared on Birthday Party, or do you not want
to
repeat yourself?
These are all new. So it's like the movie Stephen Tobolowsky's Birthday Party also come from my life.
Mm-hmm.
But the stories I'm doing on the Tobolowsky files are basically brand new stories. But of course, some of them come from the same era. Some of them crisscross. Some of them cross-reference with the stories of Birthday Party because it is my life. It's one life. So, you know, I try not to duplicate. I try to move on and tell another aspect of a certain story. So it's all new stuff.
Yeah, it's sort of like the spin-off TV show of the hit movie, I guess.
I think
If you want to put it in industry lingo. Speaking of TV, you've done a lot of television work. Of course, you were in Seinfeld, S-Tor. You also appeared in Glee. You appeared in Glee recently. I think you're shooting Californication. And you also, of course, again, I like hyperbole. My favorite, I've only seen one season, too. My favorite show that I claim to be the greatest TV show of all time, Deadwood. You had a role in that. So
I agree. I mean, you could make a great case that Deadwood, in its way, is certainly one of the absolute greatest shows ever made for television. Absolutely. No question about it. The quality, the writing, the sets, the acting, the directing, I could say, Josh, clearly it's not for everyone.
No.
You know, it is not a show that everyone will like just because the language is so harsh and the violence. But I gotta say, for what it is remarkable.
Yeah, and actually I was very disappointed. Entertainment Weekly did their 100 Greatest Movie Characters, and Ian McShane from Deadwood did not appear on the list.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, can be a really despicable person, and yet he's also very charming and hilarious, and he makes you want to say the signature line of the show. What have your experiences been like working on TV? Obviously, it's a little bit different format. What were experiences like?
Very much doing like a one-act play. You know, you have 5 days to rehearse it, you do it in front of a live audience. It's very much like a theater piece. When you do something like Deadwood or Law and Order, one of those shows, it's very much like doing a movie, but in most cases with an extremely abbreviated schedule. It's also a case where, in a way, the tail wags the dog, that the medium of television does not give itself to panoramas.
Right.
Which is why I thought Deadwood was remarkable because of its own micro way, the vista of that city of Deadwood, of that camp, you know, with that muddy, simple road and all, even on a small screen television. It had so much detail and life and clutter, it had impact. But generally, television doesn't have impact unless it's in close-up.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's in close-up, you end up with a lot of detective shows.
Right.
Because you could go a close-up on somebody's face while they're thinking of a question, somebody's face when they answer it. It yields itself to television. So that's why in most of television, you get the same kind of stories, the same kind of shooting, the same kind of twists and turns, the same kind of stuff. Whereas you have, in cable TV, you have more extraordinary things. You know, either whether it's Deadwood, John from Cincinnati, 6 Feet Under,
Mad Men.
But now you have people pushing the envelope on cable TV, because those actually become like mini novels for television. actually become a whole new Bourne because you're able to do almost anything, and you have a different kind of shooting schedule, different parameters than a regular TV show. So when you're working on something like Deadwood, like I had worked on low-budget movies where we shot the entire movie in 21 days. Episode 12 of season 2 of Deadwood, we shot for 30 days.
Wow.
A one-hour show. Right now, Californication, we shoot 5 days. 5 days an episode. Deadwood, we shot 30 days. It is a whole different kettle of fish. So it becomes like a mini-movie.
Yeah, and I would also, you made this point too, and I would agree that TV, I think, especially cable TV, but there's some regular TV shows, has become far superior to the movie.
Oh, God.
I mean, I would take, I don't know, did you watch Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles?
No, I didn't.
Okay, but, I mean, you know, I consider Terminator 2 to be probably one of the best action films ever made. But Terminator Sarah Connor Chronicles surpasses the movies. It's a character-driven show, and they really have time to flesh out the characters, and also they really do really interesting experiments. They did a really interesting experiments with the story structure that you just don't see in movies. And so I think that's a case. I mean, that's just further example. I would also say you could not get something like Deadwood in the movies.
Uh-huh.
Like, it just does not support that medium. You're doing Californication now. I rumor has it that you recently filmed a sex scene.
Yes, if you call it that. Now, whenever you do a simulated sex scene, it is simulated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so everybody always asks the initial question is, well, what is it like doing that scene when everybody is there in the room watching? And I'm going, well, nobody's doing anything. it's difficult to do one of those scenes because you're not doing anything. I mean, it would be easy to react if somebody was really doing something to you and you'd go, oh, no, they didn't. But nobody's doing anything to you, so you have to pretend things are doing to you. So it becomes very difficult, you know, as to how to pretend and to pretend to do what. And just like in action movies, what people usually do is pretend they're on Law and Order. You know, they pretend they're cops on Law and Order and say,
mm-hmm.
Okay, everybody get over here. You know, they pretend they're cops on those shows.
Right.
You know, I try to pretend for a little bit I was Richard Gere. Because he does those things all the time. But in the end, I instead opted out to pretend that somebody was clipping my toenails. And, you know, if you think about it, you imagine this now, you're all at home,
mm-hmm.
Somebody's taking off your sock. Ooh, okay. And then they pull out a metal clipper. Ooh, oh my goodness. And then they start clipping your toenails. I get, okay, that's good, that's close enough, okay. You see, you can do that, and you can simulate a sex scene.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, did your friend Alan Ball shoot the scene?
No. No, he didn't do that.
Okay.
No. He was
busy
doing Truth Lies.
Okay, yeah. I guess you've worked with so many great directors, Michael Mann, Barbra Schroeder, Ridley Scott. Which directors sort of did you have the best working experiences with? And also, like, which directors would you like to work with again?
Oh, you know, I